are some significant issues in this budget that have not yet been funded and which will, I'm sure, be raised as an issue by the chief and by the agency, including the issue of judicial compensation and also the issue of replacing the antiquated Oregon Judicial Information Network, which is a system dating back to the 80s that is in dire need of replacement and is quite central to a lot of the public safety and human services processes that go on in the state. And with that, Mr. Chair, oh, and one other thing. You have in front of you also a handout from the League of Women Voters, which they wanted you to have based on their review of the Oregon issue.
All right. With that, we would like to bring up Chief Justice Paul DeMunis. Welcome to the committee, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Chair Shields, members of the committee. I'm Paul DeMunis, Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. I'd like to begin first by thanking each of you for the courtesy that you have extended throughout this session to the Office of Chief Justice and to me personally. I appreciate that very much. The Oregon Judicial Department is a separate and independent branch of government that performs one of the core functions of government. As the one non-political impartial branch of government, our core functions include ensuring public safety, holding offenders accountable, providing restorative justice to victims of crime, protecting individuals from governmental excess, protecting children and families, and enforcing economic and property rights that are integral to our state's economic prosperity. Today, judges in every community throughout Oregon are quintessential problem solvers and community leaders that initiate innovative solutions resulting in untold savings to our state's budget. Although judicial power is one of the cornerstones of our constitutional democracy, our branch of government has no authority to fund our own operations. For that, we must rely on your branch of government. In other words, your branch of government determines for the most part what kind of judicial branch of government you want in this state. The judicial budget that you approve this session will send a clear message with regard to your value, the judicial branch of government. You must decide whether you want a judicial system that can ensure public safety through statistically and empirically based punitive and reformative programs. You must decide whether you want a judicial branch that uses modern technology to ensure that every cent available is collected from offenders to provide restorative justice to victims of crime and to contribute to the funding of judicial operations. You must decide whether a judicial system will be one that is able to recruit some of the best and brightest minds in the legal profession to a career in judicial service. You must decide whether you want a judicial system that can meet the needs of business and industry through the competent, efficient, and impartial adjudication of the increasingly complex economic and technological cases that the business community brings to the courts. Or you can make a different decision. You can decide to continue to underfund the judicial branch and thereby facilitate a slide into mediocrity that will inevitably occur despite the best efforts of 200 judges and 1,800 employees committed to the competent, efficient, and impartial enforcement of the rule of law. The judicial branch budget that I have submitted is intended to be the first step to ensure that now, and for our children and for our grandchildren, Oregon's judicial branch of government remains strong, accountable, and innovative. Between today and the end of the hearings next Thursday, you will learn about the day-to-day work of the courts, ensuring public safety, protecting children and families, enforcing economic and property rights. The presentations that follow are intended to explain in concrete terms the judicial branch budget level that is needed to enable the judicial branch to perform its constitutional role in our three-part system of government. The problems and the issues which are present in every community in Oregon today will eventually find their way to the local courthouse. The problems and issues, however, cannot be solved by the judicial branch alone. Today, many of the innovative solutions that we employ through the courts are done so only as a result of the collaborative efforts of all three branches of government. For that, you have my profound thanks. Through the judicial budget, I now invite you to strengthen that co-equal branch partnership. In the end, our constitutional democracy works because the other branches of government and the public are expected not only to acquiesce to judicial power, but to give that power effect. To sustain that delicate balance of power in Oregon government, we must maintain the public's confidence in the competency, efficiency, and impartiality of the courts. To do so, I can assure each of you in this room that the Oregon judiciary is committed to prudently managing our resources, treating every litigant respectfully, issuing our decisions timely, and zealously protecting the rights of individuals and the public's access to impartial courts. That overview, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. Questions?
Chair,
Senator Burke.
A comment. I think the Oregonian had an excellent editorial in today's edition, showing the important role that the judiciary has in the whole fabric of life in Oregon. Like the Chief Justice said, sometimes it's because it's not a political organization. Sometimes it has been. You didn't say this, but I'll say it. Sometimes it goes to the back of the line because they tend not to scream and yell, and yet their role in the process is really vital. So thank you very much for coming and talking to us.
Chair Senator Burke, thank you very much.
Yes, Senator Winters.
Thank you, Mr. And I do have a question, and maybe we'll get to it later in the presentation, but if not, it would be well, I think, for us to understand where the justice system, how we compare with other states, and I hope that there will be that kind of information. I'm specifically concerned about the salaries that we pay our justice and the problem of them being able to both recruit and as well as to retain. And so if I'm hoping that Judge that you will, in part of the presentation, that will be something that will be discussed.
Chair Shields, Senator Winters, I can assure you that there will be a presentation on that regard. I appreciate your concern about that, and I want to assure you that our presentation is being made in the context of preserving the judicial branch of government and our ability to recruit and retain some of the best and brightest minds to a career in judicial service. So thank you.
Senator Winters. Senator Nelson.
Just a kind of a clarification of figures. I'm looking at all these budgets here, and one page shows the Chief Justice recommended budget 348, but on this page it shows 370. Is there a difference there? I have general fund. This is general fund.
Ms. Lamont.
I need to double check and find out exactly which table you were looking at, but I believe that what you are looking at is the governor's recommended.
Chief Justice recommended 2 cents.
This is EBL.
But this is Chief Justice's maintenance level budget.
Which is the essential
EBL.
That's EBL. So we're actually talking about the Chief Justice's recommended budget is 373.
Correct.
And the governor's budget was 328, is that right?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
And then the co-chair's is 304.
That's correct. Mr.
Just about right, roughly.
Right.
Just checking.
No, that's a very good clarification. Appreciate that. Thank you, Your Honor. We appreciate you coming and appreciate your service.
Thank you very much.
And who is up next? The Honorable Marianne Bearden, is that correct? And Dave Factor as well, yes.
Mr. Factor, our trial court administrator in Lane County.
For the record, I'm Kingsley Click, State Court Administrator. In order to present our budget, we're starting with our trial court presentation. They're 70% of our overall OJD budget. And Presiding Judge Bearden from Lane County and Dave Factor, the trial court administrator from Lane County, are going to speak about how the budget and the courts work at their level, and then they'll be going back down with you tonight to see what the public says about the same thing. With that, Judge Bearden.
Can I get a ride?
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Marianne Bearden. I'm the presiding judge in Lane County. Mr. Factor is going to take over here in just a moment, and then I'm going to talk to you later. The trial courts is our subject. We're going to talk to you about trial courts. And when you look at any organizational chart of the courts, the trial courts, just in your mind, think, is this where the rubber meets the road? These are the people who are seeing the people of the state of Oregon, the citizens of the state of Oregon, in almost all cases, are coming into our courts, circuit courts, the trial courts, for their business. Mr. Factor is going to talk to you some about the business of trial courts, and then I'm going to come back and talk to you a little bit about some of the innovation and collaboration that's going on in the courts to try and get the business of the people done in a way that you want it done and that they want and deserve to have it done, including some of the policy choices that have been made over the years by the legislature, including treatment courts, pro se litigant help programs, and so forth. And I'm going to speak specifically about some of those programs in Lane County and also about our commercial court, which is a pilot program we started in Lane County, which is much larger than Lane County because it's a program to utilize judicial resources in a more efficient and statewide way, crossing judicial district boundaries. So it's very innovative in that way and very useful to business in Lane County, to anyone who's involved in business litigation, whether they're in the business itself or they're citizens that are affected by the litigation. So, Mr. Factor.
Senator Brown.
Just a couple questions, quick questions. Judge, I am not very familiar with the Lane County courts. Could you just tell us briefly how many judges are on the trial court at Lane County and how long you've been on the bench and what was your practice before you came onto the bench?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, we have 15 judges in Lane County. We are the second judicial district of the state of Oregon. And we compete and change places with Marion County for second largest judicial district. So I don't know where we are this week, but Lane County is one of the, behind Portland, is one of the two or three largest judicial districts. There are 15 judges, as I said. I've been on the bench since 1998. I was in private practice for 20 years and ran my own business, so I'm kind of a newcomer to public service and to the courts. I've been on the bench for a little over 9 years.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chairman Shields, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here this afternoon with my presiding judge. It's not often that she defers to me to go first, and I appreciate that. We're here today, of course, in support of the Chief Justice's recommended budget. Everything that's in that budget is really critical to the future of the way courts operate in our future.
Could you please pull the microphone closer?
The budget that you've been presented strives to meet the needs and the expectations of the citizens of our counties, of our communities, and of the state. The co-chair's budget is not adequate to meet those expectations. It doesn't consider growth in caseloads, the change in the way we do our work. It doesn't recognize how the courts have already made changes in the way we do business to meet the demands of the public we serve in both the civil and the criminal justice systems. It does not reward innovation. It is not sustainable, contrary to the stated principles upon which the co-chair's budget was developed. Continuing the spiral of decline with which the courts have been trapped for the last several bienniums will lead us to a two-tier system of justice. People who can afford it will buy justice services on the private market, eroding courts and the foundation of our democracy. I urge you to adopt and support the Chief Justice's budget request. You've been provided with a presentation, which I think is a PowerPoint. It's all in your notebooks. Let me try to give you some perspective from the trial court operations side of things. Trial courts are really central in a central component in the life of every community. On page 9, it shows, just makes a brief comment about there's one circuit court in each county seat, 27 judicial districts across the state. Courts matter because everything going on in the community comes through our doors. Criminal cases, family, children, civil, business, and the economic matters. We enforce the laws you pass and the Constitution of the State of Oregon. We resolve disputes fairly and peacefully. We enforce contracts, protecting economic and property rights, protect children and strengthen families. We apply the resources you provide to promote public safety. Trial courts around the state, as Judge Bearden indicated, are really where the rubber hits the road. You'll see on slide 10, page 10, that the 173 circuit courts, and Lane County has 15 of those, and Lane County has 15 of those, and 113 staff in Lane County, which support them. The judges across the state heard 603,000 cases that were filed in circuit courts last year. 24,000 trials were conducted in resolution of many of those cases. On an average day in Lane County, we probably send out five cases to trial, probably about 100 a month. When you look at the workload issues, it really is, as Judge Bearden said, where the rubber hits the road. Over 600,000 cases filed last year, less than 0.01% of those come back to us having been overturned on appeal. We take care of the things that come in our door, and that's where people who are looking for justice and the operation of the courts to help them resolve their disputes, that's where their cases are heard, that's where those cases are taken care of. It doesn't take away anything from the appellate courts in our state, which are, of course, one of the busiest in the nation, and who are doing their own incredible things to innovate and manage their workload a lot better, and you'll hear from Chief Judge Brewer about that when we conclude.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Westland.
Excuse me, Dave.
Sure.
That caseload drop from 03 to 04.
Are you looking at slide 12?
12.
Mm-hmm. A couple of reasons you asked me to try to explain that.
Yeah.
A couple of things, Mr. Chair, Senator Westland, that might explain that. First of all, in 03-04, that's when the courts, we closed on Fridays. We had to reduce 25% of our workload and our workforce in order to meet the budget deficit in the last quarter of the biennium. We did not appoint lawyers for cases of certain types. We didn't hear certain case types. Small claims cases were basically put in a box and not heard. the case, however, you'll see, and I intend to talk about that, but this is a good opportunity. If you look at those bars at the top, those grayish, light blue, whatever color those bars are, those refer to violations. And while they're a big chunk of the number of cases, about 44% of the things that get filed in circuit courts, it's actually a very small part of our actual workload. Violations are things that are filed by generally by police officers. You can't go to jail for them, for being convicted of them. And there's a lot of them. And they grow and they go up and down based on how many officers are on the street. When you get to the actual workload rather than the caseload numbers, which is later on slide 14 in the weighted caseload case filings, you'll see we don't spend very much time, staff and judicial time, on violations. We spend our time in criminal cases, in civil and probate and other kinds of matters.
Mr. Chair, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that one of the things that happened about that time was that they began to combine separate charges, violation charges, in one document instead of submitting separate documents, so that there was a consolidation of cases as opposed to a reduction in the total violation. So it was a technical adjustment that occurred with the violations.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westland, Ms. Lamont, that's true as well. That's been true in our county, maybe more so than in others, so it wasn't first thing on my list. I know Judge Bearden has a comment about
that
as well.
I just have one comment. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Westland, if you look between 2003 and 2004, you'll actually see there was an increase in the filings in civil, which are very time-intensive, a very slight decrease in criminal filings, which, as Mr. Factor has talked about, has more to do with putting those off. And in our county, for example, a lot of cases just haven't been prosecuted since that last crisis. And property crimes that just aren't being charged. And the real decrease was in violations, which is mostly a reflection of the lack of state troopers on their own. The decrease in state troopers following the budget crisis in 2003. So I think that those are
the
it's an inside joke.
I'm always asking, if we hire all these state troopers, what's the rollout effect throughout the whole system? That's all. These guys are
Mr. Chair,
throwing things at me.
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, the rollout's going to be an increase in criminal cases and violations, but the violations are not very time-intensive for us or staff-intensive. The criminal cases and the civil cases, the juvenile cases and the domestic relations cases, of course, are very time-intensive.
Your Honor.
You've been
right. Yeah, I knew we do.
Don't cut his pay like that. What I'm hearing from the state police is that a lot of their work now is going towards interdiction and meth cases. And so it's not just violations, it's more, they're getting more involved in drug trade rather than just
I have a question for Ms. Click, or for those of you with long experience on the bench, feel free to jump in. You started with 1994. Prior to 1994, what do you think the trends on circuit court caseloads would tell us? If you wanted to get back to us on that as well, that would be fine.
They've gone, it's been in the range. I mean, they've been in the mid to 500 to 600,000 for
as long as I can remember. There were some spikes in earlier ones. We do have it. We just, for keeping it on one page, usually do a 10-year shot, so we can give you the 10 years prior, if you want to see what trends.
Yeah, maybe just if it's not too much trouble to go back to, say, 1990 and show us, that would be helpful too. And then the other thing that I'm interested in is, we've talked a lot about in this committee over how there's been a decrease in property crime, decrease in violent crime since, you know, around 1995, at least in the FBI uniform crime rates. But we don't tend to see that in these numbers. Would you like to comment on that, or Representative Nathanson, do you want to comment on it?
May I jump in first? Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the committee, my colleagues have heard me ask a couple of times about information that we've been provided about decreasing crime rate.
Thanks.
And I have asked several times, that doesn't match my experience. I hear a lot of citizens say their neighborhoods are less safe and property crimes are increasing. So I have contacted our local police department, where I'm from, and, in fact, the last couple of years of statistics showed that the crime rate was, in fact, increasing, that it has not sustained a decrease, that some of the information we've received on the committee appears to be based on information that was old, and there is fairly recently, to be fair to people who are preparing presentations, there's been quite a bit of data that's been provided showing this steady downward trend at a national level. However, Oregon statistics do not necessarily match national statistics, and statistics just very recently made available show that, at least what I'm reviewing right now, show that the trend went back up, that crimes, property crimes and violent crimes have been showing an increase most recently. And as soon as I finish reading this stuff, I'll share it with the committee. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair, Representative, the work of the court is not so intimately involved in the crime rate. Our work comes, of course, into the court from the district attorney's office, and they're the ones, in effect, police bring them the charges. They then forward them to the court. If they're not able to bring the cases because they don't have staff to support the caseload, then what comes in the door is what they can file. It's not a clear reflection of the crime rate or the reported crime rate. And the reported crime rate is going to be your highest rate, and at some point people stop reporting because they don't get results. But there's crimes reported, there's crimes charged, and there's crimes that are brought to the court. And so there's a funnel effect that ends up with where they come in the door at the courthouse.
Senator Brown.
Mr. Chair, just a comment, and I'm not a mathematician, and David, it's really good to see you back in the Capitol. I think I'm the only legislator that was here when you were working in Salem. So
it looks like everybody else is the same, though.
That's true.
This afternoon, I recognize just about everybody walking by.
That's so great, isn't it? Mr. Chair, my question, I think what I'm struggling with when I see these numbers, at least from 1994 to projected 2007, as I look at juvenile cases, as I look at criminal cases, and I look at civil cases, the amount of cases filed, or at least the caseloads, have remained relatively static. And I don't understand that, given our increase in population, given the number of caseload increases, for example, in the juvenile, the foster care system. I don't understand why all of these numbers are staying static. So I don't necessarily want to answer. I'm just questioning why that is. Who's funneling? I understand in criminal cases that the DA funnels, but, who's funneling cases at the juvenile court level when I know the number of foster kids has increased substantially? So why hasn't, why hasn't the juvenile numbers gone up? So anyway, just for the record, thanks, Mr. Chair.
Any of you have any insight into that? I'd love to hear it.
I don't have a response.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Brown, I think part of the answer to that is the triage that goes on. When I was a young lawyer, I did a lot of work in juvenile and criminal areas, and as my practice changed over the years and I went more into civil and domestic relations law, I still did keep a substantial amount of juvenile and criminal work, keep my hands in, so to speak. And what I found was that we've seen changes in the trends of what they would deal with. If we were charging the same now as we did in 1978 when I started practicing law, the cases, it would just be astronomical. And I had situations over and over again during the last few years I was in practice before I went on the bench where I was handling family law cases where Department of Human Services, formerly SCF, formerly CSD, would have absolutely filed 20 years ago. And there was no way they could file. So I think there's a set number of, just to talk about juvenile cases alone, and I practiced there the entire 20 years that I was a lawyer and have sat out there many times as a judge, although not as a regular rotation, but in relief. When I sit out there, I find now that we're only dealing with absolutely the most horrible situations and not all of the cases that should be there. And I think it's a triage situation for the Department of Human Services that they can, there are only so many cases they can file. There's only so many caseworkers and so much that they can do, and so they have to take the absolute worst situations. And the parents use drugs, oh well. The parents beat each other up, oh well. Well, the parents are using drugs, beating each other up, and running a crack house, okay, maybe we can file that one. I think it gets that serious at times, and I think it's that way for our DA's office. I know, you know, we're one of the counties that's waiting for the other shoe to drop on the situation with the Secure Rural Schools funding. But even now, Lane County is known as a place in the criminal world where if you're a car clouder, just come on here because we do not charge those crimes. The district attorney's office simply cannot. So I think there is the only trend that seems very sustained, at least since about 1998, is a very slow but steady uptake in civil filings, and I think that is principally domestic relations, and those don't go so much on a triage basis. But I think a lot in juvenile and criminal law that we do see
triage.
Great. Thank you very much. We should probably continue on. So how much time, Ms. Click, do you think you'll need for the rest of the hearing just so that I can gain some sense of how many questions I should allow?
Well, Mr. Chair, we had, I believe, an hour and a half till 4:30.
Yes.
Let you all get on the road.
Okay.
Maybe your power bar. But in the stakeholder administrator's presentation, since we're here in local, are fine to slip, but we had approximately half an hour for the trial courts and another 20 minutes for our appellate courts before, and we had between 15 and 25 minutes for the Office of Stakeholder Administrator. I would really, to the extent that your committee is interested in our biggest courts, I would want to let
make sure that they get those questions are great. Well, let's do our best to motor through the presentation.
Okay.
And
let me motor through a couple of things, Mr. Chair. I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the innovation that goes on. I want you to know that the members of the bench that I know certainly very well, the 15 judges on our court, and the other judges that I work with statewide, you could not want a more dedicated, hardworking group. When I get together with the Chief Justice and the presiding judges annually, actually several times a year, it's quite a powerhouse group. And the state of Oregon is very fortunate to have the judges that we have. They're a very committed, very hardworking group that not only work all day long, every day, but serve in many capacities throughout the community to serve their community outside of their jobs. One of the things that we've done in Lane County is to start up a pilot program with the help of the Chief Justice in a commercial court to handle complex commercial litigation. About 2 years ago, a small group of judges, including Chief Judge Brewer and myself, started a project that ended up with the formation of our pilot program, our commercial court. The Chief Justice was very involved in the process since actually before he became Chief Justice, and culminating with the establishment of that court in Lane County in November of last year. So we've only been underway a little less than 6 months, but boy, are we underway. This innovative program had two main goals. The first was the very efficient, timely, intensely managed handling of major cases. We're talking about construction defect cases. We're talking about the kinds of cases that you read about on the front page of the Oregonian, whether it's the Capes or, you know, so major construction cases, major whatever it is, securities transactions, shareholder disputes, you name it, we're ready to handle those. And our other goal, that was the first goal, was to handle those efficiently. And we don't mean by slowing them down. We mean by speeding them up, because that's what people want. The litigants in court, unlike the lawyers, want that case done. They want an answer, especially business people, but citizens too, everybody. They want to know what the answer is so they can move on with their life. So that was our first goal, was to figure out ways to efficiently handle these cases, because there are so many parties often that you can get bogged down just trying to set up a meeting. The other goal was to start to explore the idea of using judicial resources, strengths, and talents across judicial district boundaries. I sit in Lane County, and I wouldn't ordinarily for any reason go into another county to try a case or try the case of another county, but our idea was, we are blessed in Lane County with both having a master calendar system, which gives us tremendous flexibility, and secondly, we have some terrific minds on the bench who have had long experience and practice in very complicated litigation. So if we have colleagues in Lincoln County, and I'll use that because that is a county that we have helped in this way. We got a case going on in Lincoln County. They have two judges. If they have a case that's going to take 8 weeks or 8 months to try, what in the heck are they going to do? They can't handle it. It's what we call a docket buster. It is almost impossible for the court to do that and maintain all the rest of the business that they have to do, the divorces and the violations and the criminal cases and so forth. You just can't manage it, because then you've got one judge totally tied up. And, of course, we have many judicial districts with only one judge. So our idea was, listen, if they've got something going on in a nearby county and they need help, then they can transfer that case to Lane County, and we'll try it. We've got 14 judges. We can absorb that, not like a one- or two-judge county. And we've got the resources to help them. It's not like we're sitting around with time on our hands. We're not. But it's obviously a different situation if there are 15 of you than if there's just one. So this court is open to litigants from other counties, and in consultation with the presiding judge of another county, if they want us to take one of their major litigation cases, then we'll take that, and perhaps they'll send a judge to help us with something from time to time, and we'll work out some kind of trade. But the idea is that we can prevent them from having to basically shut down to handle that kind of litigation. We have 12 cases that have already been accepted into our commercial court. Four of them are already finished, and we just opened in November. And the rest are all set for trial in the next few months. I think the latest one is in October of this year, and most of them are set in June and July. So that's an exciting and innovative program, and the chief has been very instrumental in helping us get that rolling. We also have a nationally recognized cooperative venture that we started about 5 or 6 years ago in Lane County, the Defender Offender Management Center. We call it the DOMC. This was in reaction to our dwindling resources at the state and county level. We started looking at this very hard during the '03 crisis. We'd already been trying to get it worked out, and we now work together with the sheriff's office, parole and probation, and our pretrial services staff. We were working cooperatively, actually in the same physical space, assessing risk, managing jail population, and determining needs for sentenced offenders. I won't bore you with all the details, but I will tell you that the courts work very hard to try and make the best use of those dollars. The P&P dollars, it's the same. It's all coming from the general fund. There's no reason for us to replicate work. There's no reason for us to assess risk, and then later they run a separate risk assessment. We don't need to do that. We can all do it together at the same time using one staff person and save taxpayer money. We also, as you know, have a drug court. I think you probably know we have a drug court in Lane County. There's treatment courts all over the state now that have started up. The legislature, I think we can all agree, has made a wise choice to emphasize treatment courts and to emphasize programs. I think the legislature has made excellent policy choices on emphasizing programs for courts to have that actually help people and move us along and in a way that is positive for the citizens. And this would also include our pro se programs. But what everyone needs to understand is that they're much more labor intensive. In a drug court or treatment court, the judge ends up actually doing a lot of the supervision of people, him or herself. They're staff labor intensive. They are facilities intensive. Often it requires a dedicated courtroom. They're very time intensive for the judge. It's much easier for us in terms of workload to just sentence them and send them out the door and not worry about it and let parole and probation or whoever deal with what happens later. But that's not necessarily what's best for the offender. That's not necessarily what's best for the victims of crime. It's not necessarily what's best for the communities. And I think wise choices have been made, but those are very expensive in a way in terms of time, also in terms of technology. We're way behind in technology for dealing with these situations. I just wanted to say one more thing, and I'll wrap up. We had a judge, one of our treatment court judges, actually announced his retirement day before yesterday, and I'm actively trying to seek his replacement. Here's my one plug for the salary thing. There's nobody who'll talk to me who's got the kind of experience we need on our bench at our salary level. They like me. I practice law with them for my entire career. They'll take my calls, and they'll tell me I can't. So, that's the committee.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you. And I certainly thought that drug court was higher cost at the front end and for possible benefits down at the back end. But in our Senate Judiciary or Interim Judiciary Committee meeting before the session started, we got information, and I can try to dig that out of where it's probably filed, but we got information that showed that drug courts actually save money throughout the process from the front end to the back end, with the key to the success of the drug court being the commitment of the individual judge. The one drug court that had really bad outcomes, as we looked into it, was a case where they'd rotated among many judges. It was a place in California that they studied. But system-wide, and maybe there's some concentrated areas of higher costs, I'm sure there are, but system-wide, this data showed that drug courts actually save money.
Senator Winterson, Representative Cameron.
I just to follow up, and thank you, Mr. Chair, because I was looking at the pie chart that talked about drug courts and the new charges versus no new charges, and the percentage of new charges is 10%, where no new charges is 90%, and that says that drug courts are having a positive impact. I don't think we get those kinds of statistics with the non-courts. But I would also like to ask the question whether you see the same, and I know in the narrative it talks about mental health issues, whether or not we should have the courts combining a mental health with drug courts, or should they be separate courts?
Mr. Chair and Senator Winters, we have a combined court. We call it a co-occurring disorder court. So the two would be the substance abuse problem and the mental health problem. It's just a slightly different time. The drug court meets first, and then afterwards they have the co-occurring disorders court. And it is so frequent that you have both issues that I think it is often best, or at least that's been our experience for our drug court, that it's best mostly to combine them. You almost never find one without the other when there is a mental health issue going on.
And if I may, in the court we separate them in that way, at least time of day wise when we deal with them. But in the treatment, in the people who are providing treatment services for the folks, clients in drug courts and the co-occurring disorder courts, they're in combined sort of treatment groups. They're getting their individual treatment, but they're dealing with those cognitive issues and mental health and drug issues in the same groups. They are blended in that way.
I wanted to direct a question probably to Ms. Click. The one of the things that we have been seeing here is that one aspect of the criminal justice system often dramatically affects the other. Example is one of the growing budgets in, or parts of the budget of the Department of Justice is the defense of criminal convictions. As more people become incarcerated, defense of those convictions as well as inmate lawsuits are growing. And I assume that a lot of the work in Marion County has to do with the penal institutions that are near there. Has Lane County given any thought to how a new prison injunction city might eventually affect the workload in that case, or do you have any sense of what that growth might be for a particular county that's bringing on a new prison?
Mr. Chair, I think we've looked at that in the Crook and Jefferson area in the new judgeship review this time around. So we do have some information. It's a little hard to have a direct corollary, but I'll get that in. I believe it's in the report, but I'll pull that out.
And then to follow up on that, is part of the new judges related to the fact that we will have more activity in the courts in Madras, or is that what you were getting at just now?
Mr. Chair, sorry. Yes, for the Crook-Jefferson area, part other than it's a very fast-growing area right now in our state, was related to institution and families and people who would also move as well to be with inmates in the institution. But within the institution, you not only would have your post-conviction relief, habeas, your regular appeals and growth there, but you may also have new crimes, domestic relations, all the things that go with just being a person on earth right now.
Okay. And I don't know how best to ask you that question and what I need, but if there's anything that you think could be insightful for the committee, if you could please get it to the professional staff to let us see the effect of bringing a new institution into a community, the courts. Great. Please continue. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Judge Bearden and Mr. Factor, thank you for coming up today and testifying. You made a comment about not being able to hire somebody, and I've got to observe Judge Graves' drug court here in Marion County and recognize it's a special person with special talents that is able to administer a program like that. What would be the starting salary for this person that you're trying to recruit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, the judge who's retiring is not currently our drug court judge. It's Judge Larson, and he's been very involved with our drug and co-occurring disorder court and with the governor's meth task force and other things. But he is not currently handling that docket. We have another judge, Judge Mitchell, who's been very active in the drug court, who's currently handling that. When we talk to members of the bar about a life of public service on the bench or a career of public service on the bench, and when they talk to us, frankly, about it, which doesn't happen much these days because of the salary level, we're talking to people who almost without fail are making more money. We are often, almost always, actually, the lowest paid lawyer in the courtroom when we're in session. And our particular needs in Lane County are a little different than some of the other counties, but they're not much different than other counties. With our commercial court, we're, of course, going to want to be attracting and retaining lawyers with broad civil background who know how to try big civil cases, big complicated civil cases, and that's quite a trick at this salary level. I think the level that the Chief Justice has requested in the Chief Justice's requested budget is the minimum that we could start to interest people in a career on the bench. The discrepancy is so large. It was pretty large 9 years ago when I came on the bench and took a 100% pay cut to serve the people of the state of Oregon. But the discrepancy has grown tremendously since that time. And lawyers are very well paid, and especially experienced lawyers who know how to try big cases, whether they're civil cases or criminal cases, they're making a lot of money, and it's very difficult to attract and retain them. We have a lot of judges now talking about leaving the bench the first second they can, leaving at 60 instead of presumably staying on to 65 or so, just to go back out into private practice and do big private mediation, the kind of thing we're really, frankly, very worried about, because we do not want a privatization of the legal system in Oregon. That's not good for anybody, and that's the direction we're headed.
Judge Bearden, I really want to know, for the record, what that salary would be that we're going to pay a new judge. Do you know how much it is today?
It's all the same. Excuse me.
If we're going to go out and hire an attorney off the street today for a judge position that you're recruiting for, how much is it a year?
It's $95.8, Representative Cameron.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, since we're putting things on the record, I think we should put on the record, I believe that we're at the bottom nationally.
Except for Montana.
No, Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, Montana has just passed us. We are number 50.
So we're 50. No longer 50, we're 49 now?
No, we're 50. Montana passed us, they're paying more.
So I was correct, we're 50.
We're number 50.
In fact, that was kind of an ongoing theme in joint ways and means on just about every parameter of the state.
Everything.
45th to 50th. Senator Brown.
Mr. Chair, I picked up on that theme as well, in higher education and a number of other issues. I want to go back. Page 15, you talk about the pro se and the family law cases, and had an experience while practicing out at juvenile court this year of the family law facilitator in Multnomah County, and I believe was only a half-time position, and very intrigued by the interplay with family law and juvenile court, where, frankly, I wouldn't dismiss, as representing the child, would not dismiss juvenile court cases until one of the parents got an actual custody order because concerned about a parent's ability to protect. And we had one half-time facilitator to help these mostly very low income, not well-versed with the legal system, parents with the system. And I'm just curious, what does the Lane County Court have, and do you think this is adequate, and how effective do you find these family court facilitators?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, we have one part-time person in that role, and I'll just a little plug for the facilities issue. Her office is a closet. We literally took a closet and made it into her office. In fact, I've been seen for years since I became presiding judge, roaming the hallways, seeking closets that we could turn into offices, because we have no room in Lane County. That person is very effective in helping, but there's way too much work. There's so much work to do with these pro se litigants. When I started practicing law in 1978, pro se litigants in domestic relations cases were very scarce. It was very rare. Almost everybody had lawyers. And now in domestic relations cases in Oregon, in 69% of the cases, at least one of the parties is representing themselves. And it's like doing brain surgery on yourself. They desperately need representation. They aren't representing themselves by choice. They're representing themselves because they can't afford it. We need more help for pro se litigants, and we are not able to we're not able to provide what we need to provide. We're doing the best we can with an inadequate amount of staffing, but and I will tell you, Senator, that what often happens is the judges and their law clerks and staff end up providing more help than we're comfortable actually helping. We end up trying to walk very carefully on that line, not practicing law, but those people need a lot of help, and it's very labor-intensive. They don't know what they're doing most of the time. There are, of course, exceptions, but they need a lot of help. I hope that answered the question.
Thank you.
All right. Do you have more comments, or should we move on to the tax and the appellate courts?
We can move on.
Chair Shields, I was going to As we move on, I was going to say a number of the efficiency and the improvement programs the courts have been doing, you will hear about when we go through our both our performance measures and through our policy option package in the discussion of mandated caseload. We'll cover that information and have more time for questions there. I did want to have the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals be able to present. They're about, with the tax force, about 20% of our budget from the operations includes the records office in that.
Okay.
And then our stuff we will put with here next week, which actually it'll fit better.
Yeah, the
like
Section C.
That.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I'm going to have to leave at 4:20, so my apologies for...
Okay, we'll have
we'll continue on until 4:30, but okay. Senator Wesson will be presiding.
Mr. Chair, before Judge Bearden leaves the dais, I just want to thank you for your very articulate expression of the problem and putting it in perspective from someone who serves so nobly on the front line. I mean, your words are incredibly important to us, and I know I speak for Chair Shields and indeed the whole committee when we all say thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wesson, thank you very much. Thanks for those kind words.
Thank you, Your Honor, for coming to testify. I'll see you tonight. Mr. Chief Justice.
Thank you, Chair Shields, member of the committee. I'm pleased to be joined this afternoon by my by my great friend and colleague and marvelous Chief Judge of the Oregon Court of Appeals. I will make this fairly brief. I'll begin with the tax court. Judge Brewer will do the Court of Appeals, and then I'll finish with the Supreme Court. And that should take us right to, you may have to leave a little bit before we finish.
We'll leave it in the noble hands of Senator Wesson.
So let me begin. The Oregon Tax Court is led by Tax Court Judge Henry Breithaupt. It's one of only three state tax courts in the United States. The tax court is located here in Salem. It has exclusive jurisdiction over cases that involve Oregon's tax laws. I'm pleased to report that in the magistrate division of the tax court, it takes an average of only 7 months from the date of filing to the day of the magistrate's written decision. In the tax court, a substantial number of taxpayers elect to defend or prosecute their cases without the benefit of attorney representation. And I would like to commend Judge Breithaupt for the initiatives that he has taken to make the tax appeal process as transparent and as user-friendly as possible, particularly through a tax court website and the tax court's public outreach program. Thank you. Judge Brewer?
Thanks very much, Chief and Chair Shields and members of the committee. It's a great pleasure to talk to you today. I'm Dave Brewer. I'm the Chief Judge of the Oregon Court of Appeals. I've been a judge in the Oregon court system for 14 years. I started out as a trial judge in Lane County Circuit Court, along with Judge Bearden, was there for 6 years and been a member of my court, the Court of Appeals, for 8 years. The Court of Appeals is a 10-judge intermediate appellate court that is elected statewide with a central office here in Salem. With the exception of a certain number of appeals that go directly to the Supreme Court, we receive every appeal from decisions made by the state's trial courts and administrative agencies. We're a mandatory appeal court. That means the citizens of Oregon have an unqualified right to appeal trial and agency decisions to our court. Our doors are open to them. If a litigant is dissatisfied with a decision from our court, he or she may seek review of that decision to the Chief's Court, which has discretion, the Supreme Court, whether to accept the case for review. Historically, the Oregon Supreme Court has reviewed between 7% and 9% of the Court of Appeals decisions. There are 39 intermediate appellate courts in the United States, and the Oregon Court of Appeals generally ranks first or second among those or any other appellate court for that matter in terms of caseload per judge. Over the last 10 years, we've averaged between 3,500 and 4,000 appeals filed per year. I know you've got a limited amount of time today. I've got plenty of information about what factors affect that caseload from year to year that may be of interest to you. I'd be glad to share those with you sometime and answer any questions about that. But rather than take time, I'd like to cover a few of matters that relate to our workload and some of the programs we're involved in and stand ready to answer any questions you have. To meet the demands of its caseload, our court sits in regular panels of 3 judges each out of the 10 judges on the court. Each panel has a presiding judge and 2 additional members, and each panel sits on an average of 3 to 4 sittings per month with an average of 12 to 30 cases heard in each of those sittings. We also have a 4th sitting that I chair each month that handles fast-track cases which are given priority by statute or court rule. And chief among those kinds of cases are in-custody criminal appeals, juvenile dependency and termination cases, land use and workers' comp appeals. Since the mid-1980s, the court was formed in 1969 by statute. We're a statutory court. We've worked very hard to manage our caseload. Today, once a case is submitted for decision, a written decision generally is published within 3 to 4 months, and it takes about 90 days to schedule a case for oral argument after it's been fully briefed. I checked today. On average, we have about 235 cases under advisement for written opinion at any given point in time. And right now, we have only 5 cases that have been submitted for 12 months. Any case that has been submitted for 12 months is too many. It should be 0. The way that we keep the number as low as we do is we have a number of staff attorneys on the court, 7. They're all exempt from minimum hourly workload demands by law. The average judge on our court, I would estimate, works from 50 to 65 hours a week, and our staff generally work in that range too in order to meet the demands of this caseload. I do want to mention briefly a couple of programs that we've adopted to carry forward our mission. The first is our appellate settlement program. One of the things we like to do is to keep the docket moving, to continue to identify cases that should be settled, even on appeal, after there's been a trial court or an agency decision. Each year, we're able to settle between 150 to 200 of our cases, civil cases, domestic relations, workers' comp cases, through this unique mediation program. And our settlement rate, which is the highest in the nation, is 70%. The feedback from participants in this program is positive. We believe that an effective settlement program engenders public trust and confidence and helps us decide our cases more expeditiously. Secondly, as you know, many of our students today in school receive little civics education, and we recognize our role as a statewide court. We believe in making that work accessible and understandable to the public. For that reason, our court regularly sits in schools throughout the state of Oregon, holding oral argument, talking to students and community groups about the importance of the rule of law and how our government works. During the next few months, we'll hold court sessions in public schools in Prineville, Portland, Madras, and Newburgh. And if any of you would like to have the Court of Appeals sit in your community and have community activities relating to that city, please let me know, and we'd be glad to accommodate you. I just mentioned briefly 2 other programs and then be quiet. Our slides, by the way, are at 24 to 26 of your materials. One is our appellate case management system, and the chief has been an incredible leader in trying to bring our appellate court case management information system kicking and screaming into this century. It's been very difficult. For the last 25 years, we've been operating with a trial-based system that doesn't even use appellate codes, with an increasing prevalence of miscellaneous as a category for tracking docket entries. And one of the things we need to do to be both internally and externally accountable is track and manage our caseload in real time. This system, which will be finished by the end of this year and has been underway for the last 18 months, is going to enable us to do that. We're very excited about that and would love to spend time talking with you about that in detail, too. The other thing I'll mention briefly, because Senator Brown is here, one of the things that the chief is committed to doing and I'm committing to doing is to think of our justice system as a system that doesn't just involve one single enterprise or one single court or even one single branch of government. I, like Senator Brown, have a strong interest in juvenile and domestic relations cases. When I became chief judge, I was vitally interested in managing that caseload much more effectively in deciding the cases more expeditiously in keeping with the demands of providing justice to children and families. And so we have, for the last 16 months or so, had a program underway of identifying efficiencies that we could accomplish in improving the time to decision in these, in this critical area of our work. Supreme Court's doing the same thing, and for the first time, we've involved all three branches of government, including the legislature, Senator Brown, Representative Krieger, Representative Schaffler, representatives of the executive branch, including DHS, and the governor's office, to try to figure ways to make this system work better from the trial, in fact, pre-trial, from filing and identification of these cases all the way through the end of the appeals. We think if you look at it myopically, you're never going to get to this. And so we believe in system-based programs and projects, and I thank Senator Brown for her commitment to this as well. With that, I'll stop.
I have a quick question for you, Your Honor. Where does the appellate court put most of its energy? Is it, are most of the cases criminal, civil, or how does it compare when looking at that earlier chart?
Thank you, Chair Shields. That's a great question. About 60 to 70% of the Court of Appeals caseload is criminal or prisoner litigation, consisting of post-conviction relief and habeas corpus cases. About another 15% is domestic relations. About 5 to 7% is agency review, primarily land use and workers' comp. The remaining, roughly 15% or so, regular civil.
And one of the things that we've seen with the DOJ defense of criminal convictions is that the death penalty cases take up a disproportionate amount of that time. I assume that's also the same in the appellate courts?
Well, Chair Shields, I'll defer to the Chief on that, because one of the direct review case types that the Supreme Court has without the intervention of my court are death penalty cases. The only death penalty cases the Court of Appeals sees is in post-conviction cases where there are challenges to the competency of counsel. We've had three of those in the last 2 years, and they have been docket busters. They take an extraordinary amount of time. And I'll defer to the Chief on the rest of that, if you don't mind.
Do you like to comment, Chief Justice? Sorry.
I think Judge Brewer, Chair Shields, has accurately described in both courts what the death penalty cases are about. They take an extraordinary amount of judicial resources. And I think we all of us have to think about these cases as 20 to 25 year cases as they wind their way through the state courts, through the direct appeal, and through the post-conviction certiorari to the Supreme Court and into the federal system. And along the way, we're responsible to making sure that those records that go along with those cases are preserved and available for the courts and the lawyers at every stage. So we need to think of these as quarter of a century cases.
All right, thank you very much. Is that all we have for Part B?
That's the Court of Appeals, Mr.
Okay,
Chair.
Gotcha.
And I've been given the privilege of presenting the Supreme Court to you. And I want to thank, though, again, Judge Brewer for his innovative, creative, and dynamic leadership of the Court of Appeals. I'm very proud of that court and what it means nationally. They are recognized. Judge Brewer wouldn't say this, but the Court of Appeals is recognized as one of the one or two top appellate courts in the nation. As Chief Justice, I'm honored to preside over the work of the Supreme Court. The primary work of the Supreme Court is the discretionary review of decisions of the Oregon Court of Appeals. In 2006, our court decided well over 1,200 petitions asking the court to review a decision of the Court of Appeals. When I became Chief Justice in January 2006, I initiated a comprehensive court-wide analysis of work distribution among the justices and court staff. That initiative has committed the Supreme Court to improving both the number of written opinions that our court issues and the time from filing to written decision. I am pleased to report that in 2006, the Oregon Supreme Court issued 109 written opinions. That is 31 more than the court published in 2005 and more than in any year in the past decade. I'm also pleased to report that the court has been making steady improvement on its time to decision. Over the past 2 years, the court has been deciding most of its cases within 6 months, and in 2006 decided nearly 40% of its cases within 3 months from argument to submission. I want to congratulate my colleagues on the court for their dedication to the timely resolution of the important cases that are entrusted to our court. Like the Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court holds oral argument at educational institutions across the state. In 2006, we held court in Ontario and in Baker City, and I am so pleased to report that in Ontario, we had 600 citizens attend our oral argument. A great majority of them were high school students bused from all over Eastern Oregon. We had, when we appeared at the Rotary and Kiwanis Club in Ontario, we had 150 citizens come to that lunch to interact with the Supreme Court. So I echo the words of Chief Judge Brewer. Civics are not taught in 38 states anymore, and where that is taught, it's not taught so well. And we're trying to take up the slack to make sure that our young people understand and our citizens understand the importance of courts to our constitutional democracy. Finally, this is very important to me. For the first time, this court's 147-year history, two women, Justice Martha Walters and Justice Virginia Linder, are serving simultaneously on the Supreme Court bench. Already, in their brief tenure, they're making significant contributions to the work of the court. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the Chief Justice?
I don't have a question, but I do have a comment, and I do think that the opening remarks of Judge Dominguez was very appropriate when he talked about the... I think sometimes we forget that the court system and judicial system is a branch, and we look at it and we provide the funding for it. However, if I look at the graphs and the charts that they have presented to us and we look at the amount of work that they have to do, I'm very troubled and concerned about being at the bottom of the heap when we talk about the salaries for our jurors. As a legislator and a citizen of this great state of ours, I think we asked a lot of our public servants, and we asked a lot of the courts. And when they're in a position of where they have the difficulty that they can't recruit individuals to serve as jurors because they could make more by not serving, I think we have quite a quandary, fellow legislators. And I just want to go on record saying that I do appreciate the courts, and I do appreciate the work that you do, and that the work that you do sometimes get forgotten and neglected, and I want you to know that I'm not going to forget you.
Sure. Vice Chair Wesslin, Senator Winters, I would just like to offer one comment in response to those very kind comments. I would like everybody in this room to know that while we have presented issues that affect the judiciary, I can speak for all nearly 200 judges in this system that we are privileged and feel honored every day to adjudicate the cases that are brought before us and to do the work of the people. It's a privilege and an honor to be a judge, and we appreciate that. Thank you.
Any questions?
You know, sometimes it's smarter to keep your mouth shut.
What did I say?
But we hear some of the issues, concerns, challenges, and creative problem solving that the judiciary has put forth today. And at some time, we've just got to stop and recognize that they can not do that for forever. They are going to reach a point of diminishing returns, which affects the quality of life of every Oregonian. And until this body recognizes that there are other budgets in equally desperate shape, and until this body is willing to take the leadership and stand up and say, no, we are no longer satisfied with mediocrity. We are no longer satisfied with a post-Measure 5 Don McIntyre Oregon, and raise some revenue, then we are going to continue to hear pleas, as we have heard today. It is time. Any further comments? We're adjourned.